Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, preparing you for National Vietnam War Veterans Day this coming Tuesday, March 29th, with memories from a couple different Vietnam veterans today. VFW Post 10147 in Apopka, Florida is a pretty special place, I've learned. You've heard from a few different veterans in recent weeks whom I had the privilege of meeting right there, and we're not done yet. The person who made all of that possible is a 25-year Army veteran named Colonel Loretta Forlaw, or Dr. Forlaw if you prefer. She earned her PhD while on active duty. She continues to help mentor the nurses of today and tomorrow, but we're going to hear her nurse's perspective on the price of freedom visible not just with the more than 58,000 Americans killed during the Vietnam War, but also in the thousands more who returned with significant injuries, visible and invisible.
I love nursing. It's so perfect for me. It was just God's blessing in a thousand ways, because I could never have been as happy in my profession as I am as a nurse. I mean, I always knew from day one that that's where I belonged and that's what I wanted to do. So then it came time to go in the Army. As I said, I did my basic training, and I was actually assigned to Fort Belvoir on the orthopedic floor. And it was just such a great experience because I was a new nurse, and most of the young men on that floor were from Vietnam and they had injuries of some sort. There were some sergeants and a few other folks, but most of them were young men who were dealing with injuries, especially some that were going to be in wheelchairs for their first time leaving the hospital. And I actually had a lot of empathy for them, and we got along great. And I don't know how I knew it, but I would know to fix things on the backside of the curtain so the supervisor wouldn't see them. So, you know, they just loved me because they could get away with all kinds of stuff because I would help them. I did not help them with marijuana or a few other things. Like, I learned that at the time, one of the big drugs was Darvocet. So, but you could take the little pink part out of the Darvocet, save it, and get really high on a few of them. So then we had to, like, watch them take their meds. So I say that because it's so funny that people think about when they come back and you see a movie like what did happen to some patients in VAs and other places. But in our environment at that time, in an Army hospital where they were sharing beds and all, they were just looking out for each other. And when we had to tell a story for the Women's Military Service Memorial in Vietnam, the one I put for mine was one evening we had a young man who had a fat embolism, and it was just, he could have died. So all of us were absolutely focused on him. And so all the rest of the ward was kind of on their own. And like I said, some of these people were patients, young men were bedridden. I mean, they would have a hard time getting up. And there's a young man coming down the hall, and he's got two urinals on his crutches. He says, "Don't worry, ma'am, I got it. I know how to empty them." You know, and you're like, oh yes, this is why I love the Army. That would not have happened in any civilian experience, probably.
Was it hard at all, or eye-opening to see the shape that some of these guys were in physically and also maybe emotionally and mentally?
Yes, it was, because they are young, you know, and they would say, man, if that bullet had gone here or there, and how my life would be changed. And it was hard because it is true that there were young women who married these men who expected them to be killed in combat. So they would be broken up when they came back, and that girl that they had just married before they left is no longer interested in them, and there's not a relationship there. And I don't know why our little cul-de-sac of the unit saw so many of those, but I was just struck because there were four situations in that year where women specifically did that. And we also tried to discuss that with some of the soldiers where women were just visiting them on the floor. And you couldn't really restrict it because they were friends, you know, that sort of thing. And so those kind of hurts were worse than their war hurts in some ways, or at least that's how it appeared to us, or how they shared it. You know, like the leg was going to heal. Eventually the bone would be fine, they'd, you know, leave, and that sort of thing. So it was more often the cases of those emotional hurts when they came back, not having family to come visit, or, you know, they were a young person who was in foster care. So they really don't have family except the Army family, which always took care of them, and folks always came, and we took them out to eat and did all those things that made it, you know, more tenable for them. But I always remember how when the young men in wheelchairs would go home and we would really talk about, okay, we've got to do this and that and we've got to be sensitive to this, because they really would be crushed sometimes when they came back just because they were in the wheelchair. Everybody treated them well. Their family was glad to see them. But just to really see how they couldn't do what they did before. You know, like some of them, homes were smaller then. So there were many homes that they went to where they couldn't fit through the bathroom in the wheelchair. You know, even if they could have taken care of themselves, they couldn't get into the bathroom. So we'd talk through those issues. And we weren't using social workers or other people as much. So I was, especially when I worked the night shift, I'd spend a lot of times just sitting by people's beds and talking. Again, I was not on a floor where we had a lot of the double amputees or triple amputees that I would see in Vietnam. Most of those went to the VA hospitals. The Army hospitals had more of the getting well soldiers, if you would.
And you just said, you know, that you would see in Vietnam. So I want to talk about Vietnam. But did you have a feeling one way or the other about the prospect of going over there, of leaving the States, as challenging as what you were doing there was, but leaving the States and going over to Vietnam?
Not really. I guess it's just always sort of part of my nature to be happy traveling. You know, it's not something I recognized till later in life, but I was perfectly happy to go to Texas. I was happy to go to Virginia. I went back home, of course, and then for a vacate visit, and then to get on the plane to go to Vietnam. One of the things I read a few years ago by a couple men, sorry, I don't know their name right now, but they're both quite famous and they wrote a book. They were West Point grads and they were from the South, though, and how they didn't see Vietnam as anything except a patriotic duty. And I think that's how I saw it, because at my home in Charleston, people were not marching in the streets like they were up in Boston at some point. And other places, you know, like I have a lot of friends over the years, or right when I returned from Vietnam, who were people who had marched against the war. But at the time that I went to Vietnam, I had none of those political views at all. My biggest trepidation was knowing that I would be taking care of really sick people with only a small amount of experience under my belt, because I had not worked in the emergency room, you know. And I don't actually remember my time in the emergency room when I was a student nurse, and we probably didn't. So that was my biggest trepidation, was would I know what I needed to do? And when we landed in Vietnam, which the flight, I don't have any particular memory about it being one way or another, but when we walked off the plane, Pan Am plane, by the way, and the heat, I mean, just getting the heat almost literally knocked us down. That, you know, and just seeing the starkness of that airport where we landed sort of made it hit home that we would be there. When I was to go to the hospital to which I was to be assigned, I met someone. We were both being assigned there because there were some nurses leaving. They were actually leaving under a cloud, but they were leaving. So we happened to have sat together on the plane and then were assigned to the same place in Vietnam. And then arriving where I was to be stationed, and, you know, it was pretty much, oh, the process of being welcomed anywhere. You know, here you are, here's your room with this single bed in it and that sort of thing. And then, but seeing that, the hospital was very stark. You know, none of the amenities, no pictures on the wall, nothing like that. And that first assignment I had was in Quy Nhon. It was on the water. And there was another hospital there, the 66. I was at the 85th evac, assigned to the 85th evac. So again, we took care of sick people and sick patients coming in, but not fresh combat wounded as much. They were more to be heading off to Japan or different places. But then I was transferred to Phu Bai, which is nearer to the north, Vietnam, Phu Bai being the main city. Our Wei is the main city, but we were half an hour from Wei. And then we were just in tents some of the time, but we also had wooden buildings. But then we would actually just have 100 soldiers arrive. And there's always talk of the golden hour, and physicians talk about that. And I was always sad I never wrote anything about it, because what we recognized as nurses was that we had to be out and put an IV in the patient within 5 minutes. The minute they realized they were safe, their blood pressure went down. So we actually literally went out to where they were getting off the helicopter and put our IVs in. And we recognized that there was a window of time when you were more likely to do well with them. The other kind of experience we had with just the folks who had a nervous breakdown, if you want to use those terms, that's what we said in those days. That sort of thing is that as a female nurse, I could calm them down. But the male nurses, you know, they just go. But as soon as they saw us, and we did use the term, as soon as they saw a round-eyed woman, they would, like, look at us, and we could talk to them and usually get them out of that acute episode while other people couldn't. So even if you were sleeping and somebody was totally crazy like that, you would, or, you know, under stress like that. Some of them, it was just some drugs they'd gotten hold of, to be honest. But whatever the reason, we'd go and talk to them. And whatever the reason, we'd go and talk to them. And just as human nature, they would respond to us and save people hours of trying to manage them.
Were you in a pretty safe sector there, or was there, you know, cause for concern?
There was cause for concern, but not as much as some of the other places. I only remember two evenings in all that time that we were pretty sure we would be in harm's way and that someone would overrun our camp and that sort of thing. And it's one of those things where I don't know if I heard it so much and I made it up, but I do believe one evening we were given guns in case we needed to protect ourselves. But we were always theoretically rockets around us and some of that. At the time, there was no discussion of Agent Orange. My understanding is I was in an area with Agent Orange and getting my medical follow-up. I'm very fortunate and very blessed. I have no, you know, sequelae related to any thing known to be associated with Agent Orange or anything, really. So I'm very grateful for that. But you always were so focused on other people's hurt and worry, because we actually sort of learned to accept men who would come. The guys, they're 19, you know, or maybe they were 45 and they had a heart attack and we would take care of them. But they would be 19 and they would come in and we'd have them just stay overnight before they went home, because they would really express that they were afraid they were going to shoot people when they got home. So we spent a lot of time. I don't know. I always felt privileged to be there to take care of those young men and to listen to them. And they, you know, because people sometimes wanted to make fun or something like that, but I could, for whatever reason, empathize with them with what they'd been through out there, and that was a real need, that they weren't just, you know, shirking duty. And we've had men, young men that didn't want to go back, that had to go back, you know. And I remember one young man who got sent back, and he had his missing hand up in the air telling the doctor that we were working with, see what you did to me, because he's had to send it back because there was no reason not to. So I think a lot of that kind of hurt doesn't get talked about enough because we focus so much on the loss of limbs. Yes, I took care of a lot of young men briefly who had three limbs missing. I was fortunate enough that we were near the Seabees. So the Seabees are the builders for the Navy. And so we would honestly go out to the Seabees and other people in the evening just to have a drink with them, even though we really didn't really necessarily want to. But it was that camaraderie of the military. So we would just go and have a nice time and talk with them, because I don't think we were looking at it in any way like they have a need the same as the soldiers. But, you know, it was just good for all of us to talk and share. And so then they came and built us a wonderful latrine. Only problem was they built it a ways from the barracks. So, of course, we were watched as we traipsed back and forth to the latrine and this wonderful new shower. So we were like, oh, thanks, guys. That was great. You know, I flew in helicopters at times when there was only one time that we were really under serious fire, and there was, like, the guys were sorry they took us up. You know, usually there would be, okay, we got to get you back because we've got to go rescue somebody. But there was one time when we were actually under fire while they rescued someone, and so they weren't very happy that they did that day. As a nurse, I didn't particularly remember being that frightened about it.
I'm sure I'm not the only one listening who might have been a little frightened by all of that. It's time for our final break, but more with this retired Army colonel whose early days as a nurse included that life-changing tour in Vietnam. When Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.